Hi, everyone. It's great to be here at Third Place Books. Does anybody know what Third Place Books stands for? Why they call it Third Place Books? Yeah, because, you know, we have home, and we have work, and then there's the third place. I just love that. This is a great third place. It's got a tavern, it's got a restaurant, and it's got books. So, what more can you ask for? And the Earth is the third planet from the sun, so something's going on there. I'm going to start with a poem. This is one of my first poems. I put color on walls, then leave, and let light tell its own story. Strange how our vague ambitions lead to such particular situations, like these white overalls with the brass clips, this collection of brushes and buckets. It was never my intention to join the order of caps and rags, but here I am. One summer evening, I knelt in a shed cleaning brushes. Light streamed through the splintered boards, and I was there to see how it landed, how it made the shovel and the rake and the dirt floor all matter. I stopped and listened. Wind swept dry grass against the dryer's siding. The sound was as close as my own breath, and my kneeling went deeper into thankfulness for this strange and lonely craft which makes me love so many things. It's called Painter. And so this is a book about nature and environmentalism, so why a book about painting? But the first chapter is really trying to break down this whole notion that the environment is someplace out there that you go drive to. That, you know, the universe is everywhere. It's right in here, actually. It's in our breathing. And it's in the paper and the books, and you just, you know, we're made of this earth. And so that's what I was trying to do with this first chapter, and that's why I started out with that poem. I'm going to read another one that gets into the politics and gets into my feeling about what's going on right now with the earth and with human silence. And it's called... Oh, I want to say something about that poem first. Keith and Carol and Lisa are here. They're deep, dear friends of mine. And I was painting this house just a few few blocks away from where they live in the Ballard neighborhood. And actually, becoming a house painter was really what kind of got me back. You know, I started out as an environmentalist when I was a kid. I think my first memory as a kid is really noticing how wherever people went, they seemed to mess things up. You know, I was like six, and I began to go, hey, what's going on here? You know, in college, I studied environmental health. I ran the environmental group. I got out of college, got a job as an environmental health specialist. And then I moved into different types of work. But I came back. And a lot of it was when I started painting and really started noticing detail. And that's really all you need to do to start a relationship with this planet and with the creatures. You don't need to go far away. It's all right here. So this poem, I wrote a little bit out of frustration. It's called I Went Looking for the Wild One. I went looking for the wild one, the howler. The Vedic tramp, the one for whom the wounded hillsides are inner burns, whose blood is stained with the old love wine of poet and earth, warrior poet, slinging battle flak out at the static, shattering polite conversations everywhere. I looked in the anthologies, listening for echoes, traced for signs in the quarterlies, magazines, best ofs. I learned it's been a good year for poetry. Grants and awards coming in, contests and prizes proliferating, the wise gray consensus counsels a return to the classics. Meanwhile, poor scientist holds extinction in a palm full of numbers with nothing but data to howl with. I think about this scientist a lot, and I wonder what it must be like to be uncovering data that predicts such momentous changes, perhaps the dying of the ocean. That's what we're looking at. And have society just walk by. And so that is the question I continually am grappling with. Why is this? How did we get here? How did the scientists find themselves in that position? And, you know, you can look at a lot of history, and this isn't a history book, and I'm not going to go into the history, but I do want to try to summarize how I think the scientists got there. I think it first started with religion, with monotheism, for, you know, as hunter-gatherers for hundreds of thousands of years, they think we had a direct sacred relationship with the earth. Everything was considered sacred and alive, even stones, and they all had spirits. And the earth was a largely giving place. It was pretty hard to starve to death on the earth when you were a hunter-gatherer, especially around here. You know, food everywhere. But then when we created agriculture, we created scarcity, and we needed a deity to appease. And suddenly God shifted from being around us to up there. And that was a huge change. And I think you see it in our language. You know, suddenly all our sacred language now is considered religious language. It all went into a certain book, the Bible or the Quran. And those, that division has just hardened over the years. You know, for a long time, Christianity was a mystic religion, and early scientists thought they were divining the mind of God when they were looking into nature and studying nature. But then around the 16th century, René Descartes and what we call the Enlightenment, which I think is probably not a best choice of words for that period of history, came along and created a real split between the mind and the body. And it was believed that, you know, early philosophers really had a hard time deciding what they could really count on, what they could really trust to believe in, because everything was always changing, and they wanted something that wasn't changing. And what Descartes discovered was that it was his mind. The fact that he could think made him convinced that he could trust his thinking to not be an illusion of some sort. And I don't quite understand it, because it doesn't make much sense to me. But it did influence a whole new approach to science, which allowed the scientist to make use of their data, which wasn't really the way it was. Before, it was a journey of knowledge. That was a journey of use and control. And out of that came capitalism. And that's when the whole thing really kicked in, and this whole separation. And now we have this situation in the modern day where we generally relate to what we call the environment through science. So if you're in school and you have an affinity for nature, you're going to be funneled to the biological sciences, the chemical sciences. But that relationship is going to be a scientific one. And over time, science and religion have gotten really kind of suspicious of each other. The scientists want to protect themselves from the fundamentalism. Fundamentalists want to protect themselves from the science because it might undermine their teachings and ideology. And so they've grown apart. And that's left a kind of vacuum. What hasn't changed is nature. It is still this sacred mystery. Yet we never talk about it like that anymore. And I think that has something to do with how this scientist ended up with this incredible information that is so important, with the world just kind of walking by. Because we just see it as something that science will handle. It's this category over there. So I'm going to read a poem I wrote for René Descartes. They've done some interesting things. Newton kind of went through the same transition, where he started out somewhat as an alchemist, and a very mystical guy. But over time, because of the political pressures, I don't know what, he slowly drifted away from that mystical approach. And the paintings of him through time are really interesting. He starts out as kind of a sweet-looking young man, kind of a poet-looking kind of guy, kind of a mystic. And by the time his last official portrait is done as an older man, he's hard, he's gray, and he has this very detached and almost mean scowl on his face. So this is a poem I wrote for René Descartes. It's called Separation. And I'll just mention, he's known for Cogito Ergo Sum, I think, therefore I am. I breathe, therefore I am. Snow falls, therefore it is. We think, therefore we suffer. Poor Descartes thought and thought, but never was. Where is his gray temple now? The human mind, that self-interrogator, is no ace of spades. Maybe a jack or a joker. We should know by now. Meanwhile, when the crocus pushes through the snow crust of April and finds the sun, that's not thinking. It's everything else. I'm reading our poem. I mentioned, religion, the way it kind of, I think of it as like a vacuum cleaner, When they created the monotheistic God, it was like they attached a vacuum to him and just sucked all the divinity out of the earth and just threw it up into this ultra divinity. And they can show, through history, the archaeologists can show how as the agricultural civilizations developed, this God got more and more powerful and more badass. And then they started to compete, and that's when the first monotheism showed up with actually an Egyptian culture. In fact, if you look at this brief 20-year period of Egyptian monotheism, it's like a template for later Judeo-Christianity. But anyways, this guy was the first to really appropriate God as a political figure, and he had this rigid monotheistic belief, and all the things he did are things we're seeing now, where he would punish anybody who didn't agree to worship his God rather than the other gods, because there were a lot of gods around back then. So anyways, this vacuum cleaner, it can be reversed, and I think that's what we need to do. We need to pull it back down, and we need to do it really, and the only way to do, how do you do it without language? So there's a poem kind of like about that. It's called The Return. Place a Bible, a Quran, and a Torah beside each other in a field, one not higher nor lower than the other, and according to no order you could intend. Then walk away, letting the high summer grasses close behind you. Autumn rains come, and the washings of time. Small needs of mice and robins shred pages into nests. Partial psalms disappear into burrows. Torn parables and surahs are winged to branches. And like this, the sacred words spread through the circling woods like widening rings on a lake. And the leather covers, the ground recognizes its own. The meal is glad, gradual. There is no gluttony here. Everything passes into new beauty. And you did not walk away, you returned. So let's return. It can be done. I'm going to read another poem. This is kind of along the lines of seeing ourselves in the earth and the earth in us. It's called February Morning. The wind all night, like a blown migration of dreamt birds around the lake edge of sleep. Now it shakes the heavy branches out the window, filling the emerging trees with fresh story. I'm at my desk, reading the world through a dirty window. Black cat at my elbow, the runic blessings rising out of the great vault called daybreak. I hold the pencil and wait, my eyes peering through the branches at the deep fastness held in the dark trunks. What thoughts will touch those thoughts? I thump my chest, hear wood.